From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we introduce you to the obsessive police detective tracking England's most wanted fictional criminals. We'll talk with writer Paul Abbott, creator of the new miniseries Touching Evil, set in a crime unit investigating serial killers. It premieres tomorrow night on the PBS Mystery Series. Abbott also wrote for the series Reckless and Cracker. He didn't start writing about crime until he was the victim of a brutal mugging. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reviews The Professor and the Madman, about the American psychopath who helped compile the Oxford English Dictionary. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Benny Golson's tribute to Clifford Brown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says the federal budget surplus for fiscal year 1998 is worth about $70 billion. President Clinton revealed the total during a White House ceremony a short time ago. It is the first federal budget surplus in a generation.
For 29 years, the last day of the fiscal year was not a day of celebration, but a day we were handed a powerful reminder of our government's inability to live within its means. In the 12 years before this administration took office, the debt quadrupled, partisan gridlock intensified, and a crushing debt was being imposed upon our children.
The figure announced today, $70 billion, is still an estimate. Complete data on 1998 revenue collection and federal spending won't be final until the middle of next month. In Malaysia, ousted Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim pleaded not guilty today to another charge of sodomy leveled against him by the government of Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Kuala Lumpur.
Anwar's plea of not guilty to the latest charge came as the Malaysian government came under new criticism from human rights groups, opposition parties, and foreign governments after Anwar alleged in a court appearance yesterday that he'd been badly beaten by police the night he was arrested. Prime Minister Mahathir today suggested that Anwar's wounds may have been self-inflicted as a way of gaining sympathy from the Malaysian people and the international community, but he promised Anwar's charges against the police would be investigated. In his court appearance yesterday, with a large bruise clearly visible over his left eye, Anwar told the court he'd been beaten on the face, head, and back, and had been denied medical attention for 5 days. No date has been set for Anwar's trial on the 10 counts of corruption and sodomy, all of which Anwar denies. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Kuala Lumpur.
About 1,400 restaurants in Boston became smoke-free today. Alex Ashlock of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
New city regulations require physically separate areas for smokers and non-smokers in eating places. The ban has some smokers and restaurant owners upset, but others, including Mayor Tom Menino, welcome the smoke-free air while dining. The new regulations do not apply to bars, including those that serve snacks, or to restaurant bar areas that are behind partitions or are separated by 6 feet from eating areas. On Monday, a judge denied a preliminary injunction filed by the Massachusetts Restaurant Association that would have postponed the ban while it's being challenged in court. For NPR News, I'm Alex Ashlock in Boston.
Authorities in St. Louis report an electrical fire has forced the closing of the Gateway Arch for at least a month. Signs have been put up after a small blaze damaged the 1960s landmark that hosts more than 4 million visitors per year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 114 points at 7,965 in moderate trading. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, this is the last day of the third fiscal quarter, but it appears that Wall Street will complete it with a whimper, not a bang. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
One day after the Federal Reserve Board decision to cut interest rates, the mood is anything but upbeat on world financial markets today. In Tokyo, Japan's Nikkei stock market lost 3% of its value today, falling to its lowest level in more than a dozen years. That was on worries over Japan's faltering banking system. And U.S. investors are pushing blue-chip stocks down today, apparently eager to bring down the curtain on what has been the worst quarter in 8 years for U.S. corporations. RJR Nabisco and Unical are two of the big U.S. companies which have warned their profits will be hurt by the global downturn. Meanwhile, the government reported sales of new homes fell 4.4% last month, and the index of leading economic indicators, a key barometer of the health of the economy down the road, held just about steady in August. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
One of the nation's largest banks has followed the lead of the Federal Reserve Board and cut its prime lending rate. Chase Manhattan is lowering its prime rate by 1/4 to 8.25%. The move comes a day after the central bank cut one of its key rates by 0.25%. Norwest Bank of Minneapolis reduced its prime yesterday. More banks are expected to follow. Lower rates should mean lower borrowing costs for many consumers and businesses, but this may not be felt right away. AMR Corporation, the parent of American Airlines, says it'll sell its global services unit as a part of a plan to concentrate on its American Airlines and American Eagle units. AMR has hired investment banks to help it find buyers. The unit being sold includes cargo, passenger, and ramp handling services, and more. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
Support for NPR comes from The Imposters, the new comedy from Stanley Tucci, one of the creators of Big Night. Opens nationally October 2nd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The PBS series Mystery begins its new season tomorrow night with a 5-part miniseries called Touching Evil. My guest Paul Abbott created and wrote the series. He also wrote for the TV dramas Cracker and Reckless. Touching Evil is about the detectives in a new British crime unit, a rapid response team investigating serial murders and organized crime. This unit doesn't actually exist in England. It's something Abbott created for the series. Robson Green plays Detective Inspector Dave Cregan, an officer who has just returned to the force after he was shot in the head in the line of duty. His near-death experience has left him obsessive about tracking down killers. In the first episode, he's investigating the kidnapping of 3 children who may or may not still be alive. Although there are few clues, Detective Cregan has questioned a suspect named Hinks and is sure he's the kidnapper. But Cregan's partner, Detective Inspector Susan Taylor, played by Nicola Walker, is afraid they're putting all their eggs in one basket without the evidence to justify it.
What if we can't find any evidence because there's none to find? It's worrying me. Why isn't it worrying you?
We can't find any evidence, so you presume it's not him. Why isn't it striking you that Hinks is bright enough to avoid us finding evidence?
Because without more evidence, a conviction's a fantasy.
Based on the fact that all you expect is a conviction. Hinks is a freak. He's an intelligent freak who credits himself with being in control of the facts. If all you're waiting for is evidence, then we've got 3 dead kids around the corner, Taylor. He did it.
I think you better speak to Enright before we go any further.
If we don't find them, and he lets them die, he won't be blaming himself. I will.
And you need to stand back. We can't take responsibility for all of them, Cregan.
But that's the only reason why I'm here. The responsibility's the only reason why I came back, Taylor. What are you here for?
Paul Abbott, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to ask you to describe in your words the concept of the new series.
Right. Well, I think Touching Evil came about from a need in British television to approach the kind of cop that is a bit more Americanized, that is a bit more a sharper cop than we're used to in Britain. I mean, in terms of clean, a clean line cop in the way that Robson Green portrays this. We've had Cracker, we've had Prime Suspect in England for quite a long time, and they were deliberately very grainy, very low contrast visual pieces. And just because I'd worked on Cracker, I was desperate to find something that was a bit more clipped and a bit newer, and I mean visually newer, and something that was going to look fresh to the audience. That's the visual ambition of it. I think the philosophical ambition of Touching Evil was to actually find a cop whose drive comes from his history. I know they all have, but you still have to find one at the top when you sit down to write a guy who's going to carry you through 6 hours, 12 hours of television. And I toyed around with the character of Cregan for a few years in different occupations. I wanted to write about the kind of man who faces life having basically faced death at some point and what that does to you.
What does it do to him? What does it do to the character?
I don't think he's nihilistic anymore. I think he's, you know, I think cops are occupationally nihilistic. That's just my take on them. But I think Cregan opts to see a hope in life, which is kind of the opposite of what we were doing in Cracker. In Cracker, we found the character of Fitz, who was basically so psychologically twisted himself that he understood psychologically twisted people. And that was a great way to go. I was looking for something new. And Cregan understands the world because he's kind of chosen to be here. He had a near-death experience from a shootout, and he wants to understand the world better. He's genuinely more optimistic than cops generally are.
He's also more obsessive, though, and that sometimes makes him more reckless.
Yes, there's a word. I think in trying to convince himself that he's, you know, he's a man who chooses to leave his wife and family, not because he wants to abandon his wife and family, it's because he doesn't think he's the right person for them. He doesn't think, with his state of mind, that he's the right person to take that family through the next 10 years, 20 years. And the great thing about Cregan is that he forms a strong bond with the guy his wife, Kerry, has grown to know. The guy's moved in. He's a very good stepfather to the kids. And you get the sense in the series that Cregan prays that this is the case. He doesn't want a guy who's going to be worse than he was at being a father. He genuinely wants somebody to father his family better than he could. And I think that's what I mean in terms of finding hope. Having faced death, I don't think he would have done that before he'd experienced a near-death in the shootout.
Paul Abbott is my guest, and we're talking about the new series that he wrote, Touching Evil, which is part of the mystery series here in America on PBS, and it premieres Thursday night. Now, the main character, Detective Inspector Dave Cregan, was shot in the head. That's what he recovered from. And he has a scar over his eye to prove that. Now, I believe you have a very similar scar over your eye. How did you get yours?
I think mine was slightly less dramatic in that I wasn't sure it was coming. I think it's very different from the way Cregan ran his life during the shootout. But I very simply, I got mugged, but it was quite a savage mugging. One night, I'd been out to see a friend playing a band and left to get the car. When I went to get the car, there was someone sitting in it. In fact, I'd only had the car about 2 days, didn't quite recognise it as being mine and thought I must be mistaken. And in the time it took me to work all that out, his friend came from behind and I got kind of whacked with a baseball bat, whacked with a knuckle duster, and then they kind of needlessly cut me up because I was already unconscious by the time they'd done all this. And I was kind of left on the floor and bleeding. And, I mean, it's bound to have an influence on the way you kind of face writing from that point on. It was quite a terrifying experience. That took me about 2 years to get over. You know, I couldn't walk in public places very easily. I couldn't, certainly couldn't use multi-story car parks, stacker car parks. I just got very afraid to go out, and it took me about 2 years to actually reduce that victim psychology into something that I could write about. I wrote an awful lot about it, but nothing exorcised it like time did. And I eventually just kind of took to very much going in public places, very much parking up in multi-story car parks, and that kind of challenging fate. And it made me artificially stronger. I knew the exercise was, it wouldn't be recommended by a shrink, But I just felt that I had to do that to put me back in the public arena.
Did you start arming yourself too? Did you carry a knife?
No. I contemplated carrying a knife, but I mean the penalties are so high. I don't think any mitigation carries in Britain for carrying a knife. So if I were to be found with that, the police wouldn't accept the fact that I'd been mugged as mitigation to carrying a weapon. It would be seen as carrying an illegal weapon and charged accordingly, which would ultimately affect whether I worked or not. So I chose not to.
Was there ever a trial? Were the people who did this to you ever found?
No, they weren't. They were, curiously, on the night, I gave a very good description of the guy who did this, because I happened to have trapped one of their legs in the car door and heard it crack, so I think I'd broken his leg. And the description I gave of his clothing, of his hair and demeanour, absolutely matched a guy they arrested that night in a casualty unit with a broken leg who was lying about his injuries. And it just wasn't the same guy. I mean, I felt very, very sorry for the guy they brought in. They virtually plastered his leg up and dragged him out to the police station where I was being taken care of, to the hospital where I was being taken care of, and made him do a lineup. And it just wasn't him. He was just a victim of his own stupidity that night.
Hmm. And
but about 6 months later, I was out shopping, kind of buying jeans, and it was a bit like a Hitchcock scene, because in the department store, I actually saw the guy who did it. But I could only see him. You know those awful ground floor of a department store is always kind of makeup and perfume.
Right.
And it's so busy and glazed and reflective. I couldn't see where he was standing. I could see the guy, and he saw me looking, and then he disappeared. And I ran, and what I ran with was what I was looking at the time. And so I was being chased by two security guys who thought I was on a shoplifting spree, and had to drop the bags at the door to stop them chasing me. And I just lost the guy. It was very haunting, because I think 6 months in, I felt like I was getting over it, and that event reminded me how embedded it was in me, because I couldn't speak for about a day. And that wasn't fear, it was anger.
How did the cops handle it? What was your satisfaction, or your feelings of satisfaction or dissatisfaction with them?
Well, this happened in central Manchester, and I think the police are very busy at weekends in Manchester, and you would have expected that I'd get, you know, the most cursory attention from the cops, but they were absolutely fantastic. And there was a very young female cop inspector who was dealing with this, who just repeatedly said, and I couldn't quite understand what anybody was saying at that time, you know, it wasn't your fault. Just remember, it wasn't your fault. They came for you. It wasn't your fault. And she kept saying, you know, you'll think after this, you've got that kind of face that people come after you. But they come after anyone. It wasn't your fault. She kept saying this. And of course, you know, for the next 2 years, that's exactly what I thought. I thought, you know, I've got the kind of face where, you know, this happens to people like me. And it never had before and never has since. But it was such an intractable mantra that came to hit me. I was so delighted she'd said that on the night, just to counterbalance the disorientation.
How did her interaction with you and the performance of other cops who you came in contact with after you were mugged affect the way you write about cops in your TV shows?
Well, to be honest, she fuels the way... She's never known this. I've never been in a position to tell her, but she actually fuels the way I write most women characters, because, you know, there was such a trend in Britain to soft soap women characters. There just was. You know, writers would always claim to be very good at writing women, but the evidence was never in their favour. And she was somebody who, you know, she was dealing very, very casually with me and very tenderly. And at the same time, she was dealing with a violent assault perpetrated by a guy on his wife. And, you know, she dealt with him like a cop deals with a guy who's perpetrated assault. She was fantastic with him too. She was very, very strong. And, you know, I've known strong women, but the fact that it happened that night in my life made me want to, certainly in terms of writing cops and certainly in terms of writing women, want to make life a bit more real in the work I did.
My guest is Paul Abbott, creator and writer of the miniseries Touching Evil, which premieres tomorrow night on the PBS series Mystery. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Abbott is my guest, and he conceived and wrote the new series, Touching Evil, which premieres Thursday night on public television as part of the Mystery series. He also wrote for Cracker and wrote the series Reckless. You know, the main character in Touching Evil, Detective Inspector Cregan, has been, because he was shot in the head, he was close to another world. He very nearly died, and he kind of comes back from the edge, recovers, and then goes back to work with this renewed determination. Were you close to another world too after you were mugged? Did you almost go to the other side?
Not quite. I think it was a bit more sordid than that for me. That in that I was left unconscious and bleeding in a car park that serves it's a car park near the cathedral in Manchester that serves the Royal Exchange Theatre. It's the fur coat and no knickers audience level of theatre viewing. And so I was surrounded by BMWs and Mercedes and, you know, five-star cars. And when I woke up, when I came round, I was still on the floor, but most of these cars had gone. So I'd been walked round by people who really should have done something about it. And I think that fueled... I wanted to stop believing in humanity. That sounds very dramatic, melodramatic, but that's the way it made me for 2 years. I wanted to stop believing in humanity, people doing things for other people. And I, you know, to this day, I can't imagine why they did that. But they're the kind of people who walk around anybody in the street assuming they're a tramp and assuming that they ought to walk around tramps. I don't know. It felt like another world. It was otherworldly in that I just thought, my God, this is... I can't believe anybody would do that. I can't believe anybody could be so coldly selfish as to just take care of themselves that night. When it was clear I was covered in blood. And wherever I came from, I was in trouble.
How did you regain consciousness? Did you come to on your own or did you wake up in the hospital? Who saved you?
No, in fact, I regained consciousness and realised what had happened. I realised how many people weren't there who should have been there, really, to help me. And just below the car park was a well-known cab rank, you know, a taxi rank. And I went down there to get one of the taxi drivers to get some help. And he actually zoomed up the electric window and took off. Didn't get any help. And in fact, it was two drunks coming out of a pub who called an ambulance. There are paradoxes I probably can't define in there, but that's how I came out of that event.
You know, when I was growing up, most of the kind of crime and adventure shows and movies that I watched, when there was someone in jeopardy, it was usually a beautiful young woman. And there was always this kind of sexual edge to the kidnapping and a sexual edge to her being tied up and held hostage or whatever. And I notice now that so many of the hostages and victims in a lot of programs and movies are children. And I'm wondering if what you think has shifted.
For me, creating that story was very, very simply from having two children of my own. And suddenly, being completely obsessed about the fact that they were, you know, recently, thinking about that story, we'd had the Bulger kidnapping and murder, which affected the way everybody perceived their children. You know, a 2-year-old child was abducted by 10-year-old boys. You know, oh my God, it wasn't even an adult, two 10-year-old boys, and he was murdered on a railway track. And that changed the way people look after their kids in Britain. That changed the way people monitor their kids in Britain. And it changed the way I wanted to write stories. It was, crudely, I knew that, you know, people feared this more than anything. And I wanted to explore that.
I get the impression from reading about you, too, that you also know something about what it's like to be a child in the hands of someone who isn't necessarily taking very good care of you. Just to fill in the blanks here a little bit, I think you were grew up in a family of about 10 kids, mm-hmm. and your mother left home when you were really young, and your father wasn't working and also wasn't collecting any sort of unemployment insurance, which meant that there wasn't a lot of money in the house.
No, there wasn't. It was, I look back on those times and you know, you talk about these things to journalists and you wonder why you ever did. But the truth of it is that all my writing life has been influenced by all of that stuff. I think everything I write about has a piece of that, a piece of me in there that's formed by those events in childhood, like anyone else. But mine, it was such a protracted period of what, from the outside now, and as an adult you're looking back, you think it was abject poverty. Of course, inside all that, you don't realise that until you get to 21 and think, oh my God, what was that? You know, I can't imagine we were actually brought up that way, but we were, and we all seem to have come through it.
Paul Abbott created and wrote the new miniseries Touching Evil. It premieres tomorrow night on the PBS series Mystery. Abbott will be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Random House, publishers of The Seekers, the story of a man's continuing quest to understand his world by Daniel J. Boorstin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with writer Paul Abbott, creator of the miniseries Touching Evil. Linguist Jeff Nunberg reflects on why a madman might be a good candidate to help compile a dictionary. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Benny Golson's new CD, Remembering Clifford. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Abbott, creator and writer of Touching Evil, the miniseries that premieres tomorrow night as part of the PBS series Mystery. Touching Evil is about the detectives in a British crime unit investigating serial murders and organized crime. In the first episode, the detectives are investigating a series of kidnappings of children who may or may not still be alive. When we left off, Abbott was telling us about his own childhood, growing up in a large and very poor family. His mother walked out when he was a boy. Now, I read that you had a breakdown when you were about 15, ended up in the psychiatric unit at a hospital, and that actually ended up really helping you change your life around.
Oh, God, yeah. It was. I think I went through such a black time just through being, you know, a transitional pubescent teenager. And then having all this stuff, all this family stuff to contend with. You know, I felt like it was, as I'm sure all the kids in the family did, that you feel like it's your responsibility to keep things on the boil, make sure everybody's all right. And, you know, my father had left by this point, and we were being brought up by my 17-year-old sister. And it just didn't hang together. The sums didn't add up, you know. It was a desperately black time, and I think I, at the same time as that, I was starting to, I was the most academic in the family. I was the only one who kind of wanted to be a writer at that point. I wanted to be a doctor or a writer, and at that point in my life, I was doing an awful lot of writing, which was completely alien to the family. You know, we didn't read, we didn't have books. And it sounds like a Monty Python sketch, you know, just how poor can you be? But that it really is the way it was, that we there was no expectation to do anything but leave school at 15 or 16 and go out to work. And I kind of enjoyed the difference for a while. I enjoyed, you know, the one who read a lot of books. I could read a book in a day. And I wrote short stories and kind of went to writing seminars by people like P.D. James. And it was a very odd thing for me to be doing. You know, it was a very wussy thing to want to do. My entire family were obsessed with cars. They're all car mechanics or builders now. And they just didn't understand all this. It seemed like I was deliberately opting out to be better. I chose to be better, I think was their perception at that time. So I didn't feel like I got anywhere where I belonged. You know, I was very good at school, but I chose not to be there because it was just, there were too many people to have to explain yourself to. So I spent huge amounts of my last year at school just going off and walking, which was, you know, it wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't, you know, the solitude wasn't the bad thing. It was because the house was packed, the school was packed. You just wanted peace and quiet. And I think, you know, considering all the blackness you have in your head when you're a kind of average 13, 14, 15-year-old, mine seemed to be complicated by, you know, the kind of architecture of the family. And I think the solitude was really good for me, but, you know, if I was a shrink looking back at that, as they did, they thought that was a very desperate thing to want to do. And I do remember days I spent on my own, not doing anything, but I'd read a book and I'd swim. It was like Tom Sawyer. but that was always perceived of as a bad thing by the psychiatric assessors.
How did having a nervous breakdown end up helping you?
Well, because I lived in a place called Burnley, and, you know, it's classically health underfunded and all that. So you don't get top notch shrinks there. But there was it's very fast track service. You know, they get you in and out in 15 minutes for these counselling sessions, and there was just the shrink there saying, you know, he was looking at the family history and saying, look, you know, it'd take you 50 years to get through all this stuff. I don't know why you don't just, you know, kind of switch off, move forward, and you know, switch that off for a while until you're kind of ready to confront it and just keep moving forward, which is what I did. And I was separated from the family and put into foster care for the next 3 years till I was 18. And I had the time of my life, I have to say. I was quite close, you know, I was geographically close to my family. It was only about a mile away, but you know, this was a family with wealth. They'd only got two small kids who were a doddle to look after. And, you know, kind of space, a garden. And it just, I was very, very, very happy there. and I was allowed to move on because these people had kind of slightly, if not middle class, upper working class ambitions for academics and that. You know, I was allowed to pursue writing or reading or whatever I wanted to do. In fact, I think I seem to remember at that time I wanted to become a doctor again. And they were very happy to encourage that. It didn't seem alien somehow to want to aspire academically, which I never did. But, you know, I'm saying the ambition was there from them and the ambition was there from me.
So who encouraged you to write, since you were from a family in which writing was pretty foreign?
I think, you know, you at school, they kind of leap on anything you want to do just to keep you there. Well, they did at the kind of school I went to. And I had a brilliant a Canadian English teacher who just loved the stuff that I wrote and put in one of the stories for a national short story competition. And I won £10. And that was, you know, £10 was a lot of money. It felt like a lot of money. But crucially, it taught me that you could earn money from writing. And that kind of clicked in when I was about 19. And I started to pursue that. And I haven't stopped since.
Did you watch a lot of TV when you were young? Did you have a TV in your house? I asked this because you're writing for TV now.
Yeah. No, we didn't. We didn't actually own one till I was about 15. We just didn't watch it. And the house, you couldn't sit in the house. It was just too packed. It was a very, very small house with, you know, usually 10 or 12 people there. And you just, more often than not, wanted to get out. You wanted the open space. And so I hadn't seen that much television. I think that's not a bad thing. I think when I got into kind of owning an apartment and buying my own television, I started to watch television with an adult eye, so I didn't feel like being ingrained by that much stuff that would steer me as a writer. I was writing short stories at that point, but I'd no wish to write television. I was writing short stories and theatre, and that seemed to suit me fine. I got into television by accident, by working for BBC. Radio 4, doing radio drama. And quite a few of those plays were recorded in Manchester. And it just so happens that the country's biggest soap was made in Manchester. And they called me down the road and asked if I'd like a story editor's job. From the three plays they'd heard, they were quite keen. So I took that and started. I think that was officially the time when I felt like I'd become a writer because I was being paid a salary.
Mm-hmm.
I think most writers would die to be paid a salary. They just want, you know, their own prices for their own voices. But that was a very mechanical job, but it was a great start.
My guest is Paul Abbott, the creator and writer of the miniseries Touching Evil, which premieres tomorrow night on the PBS series Mystery. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Paul Abbott, is the creator and writer of the new miniseries Touching Evil, about the detectives in a British crime unit investigating serial murders and organized crime. He also wrote for the series Cracker and Reckless. Your new series, Touching Evil, is about to premiere on public television as part of the Mystery series. I know you also have contracts now to write shows for American TV, for one of the networks, and for Fox TV. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think that there's any difference between writing for a British TV series and writing for American ones. Do you think you'll have to make any changes? Or is there a difference to you?
I mean that there's definitely a difference in the way they're put together. But, you know, we sit here and watch NYPD, we watch Homicide, and, you know, they're kind of best of the exports. And
mm-hmm.
you think when you're commissioned to write something in America that that's what they naturally want. But those shows were usually created by people who had a very good television experience, you know, like Butchko and Tom, I've forgotten his name, the guy who created Homicide, who were renegades and well-known renegades, but they were given a break.
You know,
Tom Fontana, yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic show, Homicide. But I don't believe they'd ever commission it knowing what they were going to get. I think they, you know, it's a bit like Cracker, it ended up on air by accident. Nobody in the commissioning territory knew quite what they were going to get, just that it would be written by Jimmy McGovern and have Robbie Coltrane in it. I think that was the prime selling point. And they were slightly mortified when they saw what was coming out. You know, how dark it was, how strong it was. And the only thing that would shut them up was an audience of, I've got 60%. And I feel that's what happened with NYPD. I feel that's what happened with Homicide. And you imagine when you're commissioned that they're going to want this kind of stuff from you because this is what you're writing. You know, you write Touching Evil or you write Cracker, and they're going to be looking for that kind of stuff. But I think they're slightly more scared of letting an incomer try that kind of stuff. So they usually want more straightforward format material, stronger stuff that is bound to work. And if it's bound to work, it doesn't actually have much of you in it.
You said that in Touching Evil you wanted to write a more Americanized kind of series, or at least a more Americanized kind of detective. What did you mean by more Americanized?
Well, it's very childish of me, but of course in Britain the cops don't have guns, and there are only certain branches of the police force who would have guns, and you know, slightly elite forces. So I went for the crisper FBI style, which isn't very common in Britain. There are only, you know, four or five units permanently supplied with arms. And I just think that you can raise the stakes on the drama when there are weapons. And I'd hate for the police to be armed in Britain in reality, but I think it actually allows you to take certain storylines further down the road if there's a confrontation with weapons involved. The truth of it is, in Britain, if a cop confronts a guy with a weapon, he has to summon people with weapons. He can't actually pull one out of his belt and start firing back. It's that actually takes time in drama, so I wanted to sharpen them up and make them slightly more... the reason I said American is that, you know, that's the true distinction, you know, the kind of... the NYPD and the Homicide, you know, the height of the drama is just boosted by the fact that weapons are present to raise the stakes.
Now, as we talked about, you were victimized a few years ago, and that has really figured into your interest in writing about crime. But I wonder, when you're watching a TV show that you didn't have anything to do with that's about crime, like Homicide or NYPD Blue, does it make you feel uncomfortable or more vulnerable because you have been a victim, or is it, you know, is it easy to watch? Maybe you could just watch it as a professional writer, too.
I think Homicide and NYPD, I'm a fan, not a writer. If I want to know what the episodes were about professionally, I get the scripts. But I sit down and watch those shows, and in fact, they're designed to make you feel better, whatever you are. I think if you've been a victim, they're designed to make you feel better because you've got Sipowitz
right.
running the world for you, and it's. They're just there to be gladiators on your behalf, so you feel more protected that, you know, people with that kind of morality, with that kind of integrity and that kind of strength are in charge.
Some people worry that crime movies and crime TV shows are, in a way, educational aids for potential criminals because it teaches them all kinds of cool ways of breaking in and new sadistic crimes they might not have thought of on their own. Do you have any concerns about that? Do you think that's a legit fear?
I don't think writers are as inventive as criminals at dealing with crime. I think they find their own way through. They don't need any help. But I think generally it's looking at the structure of preparing a crime show. Basically, it's 9/10 in favour of an optimistic morality. So if they're learning, you know, it's like the argument about, you know, what do people learn from, you know, do they learn, you know, are kids influenced negatively by these kind of shows? And I'd say, well, if they're influenced negatively, they have to be influenced positively by all the good things that you've had from Fitz, from Cregan. You know, they are people who want to do the right thing, and that's the overriding sentiment of all cop shows, that the right thing has to be done. Even corrupt cop shows, you know, they are designed in a way you can't get away from. Clean morality has to be spelled out before you can show any negative effect. I think it's a very powerful overriding signal on any cop show.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Paul Abbott created and wrote the miniseries Touching Evil. It premieres tomorrow night on the PBS series Mystery. An American psychopath played a major role in compiling the Oxford English Dictionary in the mid-19th century. His story is told in Simon Winchester's new book, The Professor and the Madman. The book has gotten a lot of favorable attention. It's reported that Mel Gibson has optioned the film rights. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks that people may have missed some of the real significance of the story.
God loves language and forgives everyone who by it lives. Unfortunately, those lines of Auden were written a couple of decades too late to serve as an epitaph for William Chester Minor, one member of the Victorian odd couple whose story Simon Winchester tells in his new book, The Professor and the Madman. Minor was born to an old New England family and studied medicine at Yale. His psychological disintegration may have begun during the Civil War, when as a surgeon in the Union Army, he was required to brand the letter D onto the face of an Irish deserter. After the war, he began to show increasing signs of paranoia. And in 1871, when he was living in London, he shot and killed a working man whom he took for a member of the Fenians, an Irish militant group that he believed to be persecuting him. The court found him not guilty by reason of insanity and sent him to the asylum for the criminally insane at Broadmoor. It's at this point that the professor enters the story in the person of James Murray, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. Minor somehow saw an appeal that Murray had circulated asking for volunteer readers to comb over works of literature looking for citations that could be used to document the evolution of the English vocabulary. A sympathetic warden allowed Minor to acquire books, and he threw himself into the task with a vengeance, collecting and systematizing thousands of citation slips for the dictionary's files. Over the next 20 years, Minor continued to work on the dictionary, even as his paranoid delusions became more tortured and fanciful. He reported that there were little men living under the floorboards of his room who came out at night to spirit him away and make him perform vile sexual acts. After a long correspondence, Murray went to visit Minor at the asylum, and the two eventually became friends. Winchester gives us a nice picture of the madman and the professor walking slowly in step along the terrace of the asylum, looking remarkably similar, tall men with long white swallowtail beards, lost in conversation about English words. That picture's worth pausing over. Modern readers may find the pairing incongruous, but in fact it isn't odd that Minor would have found the collection of citations so absorbing a task. Most people are not very good at reading text looking for the interesting uses of words. Either they get caught up in the story or they start skimming, and either way they miss important material. But I can easily imagine Minor sitting there for hour after hour poring over books with schizoid attentiveness, waiting for the revealing citation to spring up at him like a leprechaun out of the floorboards. And for that matter, the dictionary project itself would have been congenial to the paranoid's proclivity for assuming that everything has a place in some vast logical system. We've gotten so accustomed to having the OED around that we may forget what a demented and delusional project it really was. Actual speech is a chaotic and unsettled business. As Samuel Johnson said, when you look at words, their meanings seem to shift around like branches blown about in a storm. To suppose that you can get it all down in a single book where every word is pigeonholed into an appropriate sense and assigned a neat definition, well, it isn't mad exactly, but it has something of the paranoid's refusal to acknowledge that the world is a messy place that doesn't always make sense. The compilers of the OED weren't psychopaths, of course, but they were a pretty loopy lot. There was Murray's predecessor, Frederick Furnival, for example, who mixed his lexicography with efforts to protect the virtue of young Cockney women by encouraging them to take up rowing. And Murray himself had more than a touch of obsessive monomania. You'd have to sit for 40 years in a damp iron shed in your garden, sorting through millions of slips of paper with the uses of words written on them. By the way, there's a wonderful portrait of Murray in a recently reissued biography written by his granddaughter called Caught in the Web of Words. That's the first thing I recommend whenever somebody asks me for a good book about language. In Murray's case, of course, the obsession led not to an asylum, but to a knighthood. But in their different ways, he and Minor were typical of their age. From Murray and Furnival to Disraeli and Gladstone to General Gordon and General Custer, you're always struck by how many of those eminent Victorians had a couple of oars out of the water. That's ultimately where Winchester's book gets its nostalgic charm, in evoking an age that found so much useful work for its madmen to do.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. He reviewed The Professor and the Madman by Simon Winchester. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Benny Golson's new CD, Remembering Clifford. This is Fresh Air. Most jazz fans recognize the tunes of Benny Golson, even if they don't know he wrote them. Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers played Golson's Blues March every night for decades. His Stablemates has been a jam session favorite since the 1950s, and literally hundreds of trumpeters have taken a crack at I Remember Clifford. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Golson is still writing good tunes and revisiting old ones.
Saxophonist Benny Golson playing his tune Matinee. Golson composes like an improviser and improvises like a composer. His melodies sound good on their own, but they also have a sly way of drawing out improvisers who play them. He doesn't just write nice chord progressions or catchy riffs to kick a tune along, but also melodies whose shape is so distinctive, soloists can just hint at them and still sound like they're playing the tune. Golson is so highly regarded as a jazz composer, he gets overlooked as a saxophonist, which is odd because he brings the same sense of musical architecture to his writing and playing. Here's Golson in 1997 on one of his 50s classics, Five Spot After Dark. If you ever meet Benny Golson, you'll notice that he talks the way he plays, with a soothing tone, mellifluous syllables, and elegant turns of phrase. His CD, Remembering Clifford, presents itself as a tribute to trumpet saint Clifford Brown, but it's really about Golson's own ability to find fresh inspiration in an approach he's been using for 40 years. He's led sextets with three horns before, like his old jazz tet. But the sextet on his new album has the slightly unusual front line of trumpet flanked by two tenor saxes. Golson's Brown Immortal is a variation on his jazz standard, I Remember Clifford. These days, of course, everyone remembers Clifford Brown, especially younger trumpet players like John Swanna. Golson's new CD also includes a tribute to New York-born mambo king Tito Puente. It's called Tito Puente and features guest percussionists Patato Valdez and Tito Puente. This solo is by tenor saxophonist Ron Blake, whose tone is harder than Golson's, but who spins out some clever lines of his own. Of that rhythm section is Mike LaDonne on piano, bassist Peter Washington, and drummer Joe Farnsworth, all a generation or more younger than the leader. If Benny Golson's side folks sound very much on his wavelength, it's likely they all played enough of his tunes when they were coming up to learn something about how his mind works. Remembering Clifford isn't the best record Golson ever made, but like most of his work, it's consistently good. Good enough to remind us not to forget him either.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Remembering Clifford by Benny Golson and his group. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Little Brown & Company, publisher of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. And from The Imposters, the new comedy from Stanley Tucci, one of the creators of Big Night, opens nationally October 2nd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.